But it's been a busy time at Reasons to Believe. In fact, we've been sending multiple people out to different cities around North America. We've been sending Dave Rogstad up to the Sacramento area, and Fuzz has been to New Mexico. He's been to Alaska, and just got back from Florida yesterday. So we've been keeping him busy as well. Normally what we do in this class is I spend a little bit of time giving a field report. We spend some time in one of the 20 creation accounts we're trying to get through in our course of the Bible. And then we spend a little bit of time on a scientific discovery. But you know, I've been gone for so long that my list of field report items is way too long to cover in the class. I don't want to spend the whole class time on it. I'm going to give you a choice. Okay, because one of the things I did know is gone is I went to the Pacific Northwest, Portland, Vancouver, and Nanaimo, and I could give a report on that. And then Fuzz and I did kind of a media trip where we did radio and TV interviews and went to places like Illinois to do television interviews. And then I spent a few days in Knoxville, Tennessee. So which of those three would you like to hear about? Knoxville, the media, or the Pacific Northwest? Media? All right, we'll talk to you about the media. Okay, well, no. Well, what I'll do, I'm going to kind of break this up. In succeeding weeks, we'll eventually get through all this. But because right now the travel is going to start to wane off, so I think I'm going to be missing maybe 2 weeks between now and the new year. The rest of the time, I'll be in town. So And this is typical for Reasons to Believe that we do our most intense travel in the fall and the spring, and we try to get caught up on our research and writing during the summer and the winter. And by the way, thank you, all of your chapter people that are here. And that's one thing we're doing at Reasons to Believe, is we're making a strategic effort to focus our travel in those places where we have chapters that can carry on a permanent presence. I mean, kind of the strategy is that, you know, Fuzz or Dave or Ken and I will go to some city and we'll be there for a couple of days. But we count on the people who are in the chapter who've been through our courses to carry on a permanent teaching ministry after we leave. You know, it's kind of like a door opener. You go into a city, open up some doors, and then hopefully our chapter people are ready and equipped to teach classes after we leave, and they get to stay. I mean, we have to go home, but they get to stay and they can carry on ministries. Kind of like we see here in this class. Like one of our goals is we would see major churches across the country have permanent apologetics, ministry and teaching and outreach going on. So that's one of the things we're doing. But one of the trips we didn't connect with chapters, we focused on the media. And I'm just trying to get into media outlets that we've traditionally not gotten into. One that I did was ABC Radio in New York. And I didn't go to New York. I did that actually from my home because it was a 6 a.m. my time. 9 a.m. New York time. It was a secular station, and they were going to have me on for a few minutes. They wound up having me on for the entire hour. And there was two hosts. One, the gentleman, was a non-Christian. The woman, it was hard to tell whether she was a Christian or someone that just believed in God. I could never really figure it out. But they were going to ask me a couple of quick questions on my book, A Matter of Days, which talks about the young earth, old earth thing. But you know, when I got into that, they said, well, what do you do about the origin of the universe? And I said, well, we happen to have a book on the origin of the universe. Talked a little bit about that. Well, what do you do about the origin of life? Well, most of you know we have a brand new book on the origin of life. And and then they said, well, you know, we get all kinds of calls about UFOs. And I said, well, we have a book on UFOs. Like every question gave us an opportunity, and they couldn't have scripted it better. I mean, these people knew nothing about Reasons to Believe. I thought they would at least go to our website. And what I'm discovering about these radio talk shows, you usually get a host that doesn't even bother to go to the website to check you out, doesn't even bother to read the front and back cover of the book they're supposed to be interviewing you on, because they're asking these questions about A Matter of Days, and it's clear they had no idea what the book even addressed. So you kind of have to bring them up to speed, but it's kind of fun because then they say, well, you know, if that's what the book is about, what do you do about this? What do you do about that? And, you know, it just opens up all kinds of things and says, And they were really excited about the fact that we seem to be a ministry that does research on the kinds of questions non-Christians ask and develop answers for them. And so both of them were really thrilled that, you know, this is a ministry where you can get these kinds of answers. And they kept pushing the website saying, you know, because they were actually looking at the website while they were interviewing me. And they're saying, wow, you know, you got an article on this. You got an article on this. This is really exciting. I've always wondered where Cain got his wife, and you got an article right there on your website. So, and that's always a blessing for me when I see people who are interviewing us really get excited and enthusiastic, and it's like, you know, this is a neat discovery for them. And it was ABC Radio. It was affiliated stations all over New England that were picking it up, so that was kind of fun. Fuzz and I were in a place called Marion, Illinois. Probably had never heard of the place. It's a little... Oh, really? Someone knows Marion, Illinois. I'd heard of it because I once spoke at the University of Southern Illinois, and you have to go through Marion to get to Carbondale, which is a few miles north of the... But it's actually near St. Louis. But in Marion is a brand new Christian network. It's only been up and running for a couple years. And they're now expanded to the point where they have 18 major stations across the country. But their primary broadcast is actually into the Middle East and Asia. And so they have a huge audience in the Philippines, and Malaysia, as well as the Arabic-speaking countries throughout the Middle East, Iran. So they got real good exposure there. And they had us on for two shows. The first show was something called, I think it's, see if my notes are here. Oh, yeah. TCT is the name of the network. I never heard of it before. It's a Christian network. And we were on their flagship program called TCT Alive, an hour-long show. And I thought, you know, okay, we're going to get maybe 5 minutes here and 8 minutes there. And they said, oh, no, we're giving the entire show over to you and Fuzz. Now, it wasn't quite that way, because they also had a musician there. It was a live show, and they count on a guy to sing to help them set up for the next event. But this is a guy who loved to talk before he would sing, so Fuzz and I were just seeing our time kind of go away as this guy gave a little testimony with each song. So, but nevertheless, we probably got 35 minutes of the hour. And we talked about a matter of days, and then we talked about the origins of life. So I was on by myself, and Fuzz joined me for the book Origins of Life. And they pretty well stuck to the book. These are people that actually read the two books, knew what it was all about, and really were excited about the outreach potential of both books. And I think what was fun for us is we got to talk about our testable creation model. You know, how these are books we're bringing out, and we're bringing out 12 books total, that give a survey of our testable creation model. And it's a new way to kind of resolve conflicts. And we say there's no need to fight over these issues. You produce the models, make predictions based on the competing models, and then you just wait and see whose predictions come true. And that was a really novel idea to the two hosts that were interviewing us. And they said, you know, as far as they knew, this had never been done in the Christian community. And so their enthusiasm, I think, really helped. And the owner was watching it, the guy who founded the network. And he said, you know, can you gentlemen stay? We got another live show we're doing called TCT Today. And it was a different format. It's not an interview format. It's where you have a panel discussion. And so he and his daughter sat on the panel along with Fuzz and myself, and we just talked about hot items in the news. But what made it work well is the daughter of the founder is on our mailing list, reads all of our stuff, has read our books, really excited about the ministry. The dad had never heard of us until that morning, but he saw the first show and he says, oh, we got to do this thing. And that probably went, I mean, to me, that was really good. And it was a lot like this New York thing, because he said, you know, we've heard about the matter of days and origins of life. What do you guys do about the origin of the universe? So he got to talk about the creator and the cosmos, and he had all the books there, showed them up. And we got to talk about, oh, and the daughter was really excited about her DVD, Journey Toward Creation. And so she kept pushing that in front of the camera. I didn't have to say anything. She was telling everybody about what was in this amazing DVD. And the good news is that network will probably broadcast Journey Toward Creation. and they were really excited to discover we're putting it in Arabic and Farsi. And they said, wow, that's just what we need to get into the Middle East. And then I says, well, you know, we're also putting it into Mandarin. And they says, oh, Japanese? And I said, yep, that's all going to be included. So they really are excited about using that to reach out to Asia and the Middle East. So that's going to be fun. But, you know, stem cell research is in the news. And so we were talking about the Origins of Life book, and they had no idea that Fuzz was a real expert on stem cell research and already done half a dozen interviews on that subject. And so we spent about 5 minutes talking about that, and then finally the owner jumped in and said, you guys wouldn't happen to have some position on extraterrestrial life and UFOs, would you? So we wound up talking about the fights in the sky and little green men, and then he said, do you guys have any DVDs besides the creator, you know, Journey Toward Creation? I said, yeah, we got the Our UFO Hypothesis. And so they're going to consider broadcasting that as well. And then I got an unusual opportunity, unusual because I knew how hostile the host was. I got on a station in Detroit called WMUZ. It's a Christian station, but it's got a huge audience, 1.5 million listeners. And I've been on before, but usually the host has made sure that I was opposed by some prominent young earth creationist leader or several of them. He's a young earth creationist himself, but this time he decided just to take me on by himself. And we were talking about a matter of days, and he basically gave me no opportunity to talk about the book. He just says, look, I got to hit you with some of the questions I think are the strongest arguments for a young earth. And he says, what bothers me is all these old earth creationists that say young earth creationists don't have good science. I says, well, you know, you need to understand there's a difference of a factor of 1,000,000 between the old earth position and the young earth position. It's not like you can just simply compromise the two. It's not going to work. And I says, it says, you're a young earth creationist. I don't think you're going to be satisfied if we take what I believe to be the age of the universe, what you believe to be the age of the universe, add the two together and divide by two. That's not going to satisfy me. Yeah, you're right. It's not going to satisfy me. So I said, you know, you need to understand that, you know, one side or the other is speaking scientific nonsense. Both can't have scientific credibility. One's got to be. And he said, well, and he appreciated that. But he said, look, to me, the strongest argument of all is the human population explosion. And, you know, it's tough when you're talking to a guy who's not a scientist, because most younger creationists who are scientists realize it's a really weak argument. But this guy just kept pushing that one. And I kept trying to explain to him that, you know, the human population increase has not always been going up at 2% per year. If you go back just 100 years, it was a lot less than 2% a year. And he says, well, everybody knows that the population of the time of Rome was 1 million. And I said, that's not true. The population of Rome itself was 4 million at the, in 200 A.D., and the Roman Empire had a population at the time of Jesus that was 120 million that went up to 200 million. And he kept trying to contradict that. And I said, you know, just look it up in the almanacs. They'll tell you what the populations are. Read the history books. He says, you just open up the Bible. The Bible talks about battles where up to 1 million people were killed in battle. So, you know, the human population had to be significant at that time. So anyway, he decided to change the subject, and then he brought up dinosaurs cohabiting the planet with human beings. We can prove that because of all these dragon legends. I said, you know, what am I going to do with that one? Because, you know, he thought that all these dragon legends were proof that there were dinosaurs. And so I just decided to spend my time saying, you know, I think what you're saying is you believe that dinosaurs and humans must have walked together because you believe they're mentioned in the book of Job. And he says, yeah, that's exactly right. Well, you know, we've been through that in this class, right? You know, we've been through Job, 39 and 40, probably 40 and 41, where it talks about the behemoth and Leviathan. And he says, well, it says right there in the text that the behemoth has got a tree the size, a tail the size of a cedar tree. Pardon me, a tail the size of a cedar tree. So I said, well, it also says the Leviathan's got plates of steel on its belly and breathes fire out of his mouth. He says, well, I believe it breathes fire out of its mouth. So do you believe the plates of steel? And finally he said, no, I guess I don't. And I said, well, probably the reason why you don't, as it says in the text, like plates of steel. But it says, read the thing about the cedar the cedar tree and the smoke and the fire. Again, you'll see the words as or the word like. It says, these are metaphors. He says, oh, I'm taking the Bible literally. And I says, well, there are metaphors in the Bible. I mean, Jesus says, I am the door. I mean, are we going to take that concretely, that he's claiming to be an actual wooden door? Or are we going to take that metaphorically, that he's a doorway? Well, he finally got the point, and we actually ended the interview on friendly terms, which I thought was a miracle in itself. But that tells me that there are people praying when those things happen. But and, you know, Fuzz has gotten a number of amazing interviews. And, you know, what I find interesting is we've been trying to get these interviews, and they're saying, oh, no, all we're covering during this next these 6 months is politics. And so they say, well, you know, stem cell research is politics, right? Wasn't that brought up in two of the debates? And they really wanted, and these are Christian stations, and I said, look, we're talking about really good response to this stem cell charges coming in from Kerry. Because, you know, most of these are guys that are trying to push the Republican agenda. And it literally took 4 months before we could open the door. And then finally, when they figured out what we had available for them, now we're being flooded with requests. But it just took so long. And here the election's right upon us. And suddenly the opportunities are beginning to open up. So, but Fuzz has got amazing material on stem cell research, basically making a point that if you're going to work with embryonic stem cells, you basically get unpredictable tumors rather than organs that you can reap and, you know, store and so forth. You simply can't control the embryonic stem cells because the stem cells are at such a primordial level that they could, you know, become any kind of cell. And they're also in a state of rapid multiplication, so it's a great prescription for getting lots of dangerous cancer tumors, but it's not very good prescription for getting what you want. On the other hand, there are lines of stem cell research that have a much higher probability of being productive, and the good thing about that is you don't have to kill anybody to get those stem cells. You can take them from the fetus, and the fetus survives. You can take them from adults, and the adult survives. Infant stem cells. So there is a way to harvest stem cells, and when you harvest those stem cells, you get a much lower risk of propagating cancer than if you go with the embryonic stem cells. But it's interesting how the political debate is set up, where it looks like, well, you know, if you're Republican, you're against stem cell research. If you're Democrat, you're for stem cell research. Actually, both sides are for stem cell research. It's how you do the stem cell research. And what was exciting, for example, we were on TCT. We got to talk about stem cell research in the same context as, say, nuclear energy, making the principle that God has designed the universe in such a way that when we run into technological difficulties, what we see immediately is what I call the quick and dirty method. Okay, we got a problem. We need to solve the problem. Here's a quick and dirty method to solve the problem. The problem is it's usually not an ethical solution, and economically it doesn't deliver much of a payoff. But it is something that's easy technologically to achieve compared to what I would call, you know, God's way of solving the problem, which is to choose the ethical path. And if you choose the ethical path, it's the path that has the greatest economic and technological return. And the whole point is we see that consistently over the past several hundred years of scientific and technological research. Isn't that evidence of how God has supernaturally designed the universe? So if we human beings face these kinds of issues, the best pathway in terms of economics and technology is also the most ethical pathway. And we found that a lot of Christians in particular really get excited about that line of argument. In other words, stem cell research is an issue that will pass as technology advances, but we'll be confronted with new issues where we run into ethical points. But we can count on the fact that God has designed the universe that if we decide to look past the quick and dirty method, we'll find a method that has much more economic payoff and without the ethical problems. Just to give you an example with nuclear fusion. You know, probably you're aware that people are trying to find a way to get the harness the energy of the sun, so we're not dependent on fossil fuels to the degree that we are today. And the quick and dirty method that's being pursued is to take tritium and deuterium and fuse them together to make helium. But tritium is a really nasty radiometric element, lasts a long time, far more dangerous to deal with than the products you get from fission reaction where you burn uranium and plutonium. This tritium is much nastier. And the real problem is that when you fuse deuterium and tritium to make helium, you don't get much energy. It's just a bare payoff of what the energy you have to put in terms of how much you get out. Now, the ethical pathway is to take hydrogen and make helium. No radiometric elements involved. And when you go from hydrogen to helium, you get about 20 times the energy output that you do from deuterium and tritium, a much bigger payoff. It's technologically a little more difficult, but what's interesting as you study these issues is say how much more difficult technologically is it to get energy from fusing hydrogen to helium than it is from tritium to deuterium? Well, it's somewhere in the neighborhood of 50% more effort, but you get 20 times the payoff. So, you know, from a logical, rational perspective, it's worth putting the extra 50% into the engineering cost in order to get a much higher payoff from the end product. But it is a tad more difficult to achieve than tritium and deuterium, assuming you ignore the radioactive waste problem. If you don't ignore the radioactive waste problem, then it's a no-brainer. You just realize, hey, it's going to be technologically very challenging to try to deal with the waste of the tritium. And given how challenging that is, let's just scrap that program and go for the hydrogen to helium, because even though that's more difficult in terms of building a power engine, we won't have to worry about the waste and we won't have to build a plant to try to deal with that. And we don't even have a good solution for that. So that's kind of a quick summary of some of our media events. I'm giving you like the one-third tip of the iceberg. The other two-thirds have been predominantly radio interviews and we've been having in different cities around the country. Yes. Yes, there are some stuff there on the website, and also a few of these interviews, we've been given permission to put them on our website. So if you go to our website, you'll see that you can listen or view some of these interviews and get some background. Yes, in the back. Right. Yeah, it's the Jesus Christ show where you get to talk to Jesus. This guy plays the role of Jesus. Origins of Life. Oh, that is good. I didn't know that. So thanks for sharing. I did know he was on our mailing list because I've seen his name on our mailing list. And he has bought all of our books. So. Well. That's good because I only got on KFI once. And I was interviewed by an atheist. And the atheist wouldn't let me put more than three words together. So this guy's got his own show. And by the way, that's the largest radio station in Los Angeles, KFI, secular station. Has a lot of rather profane programs on it, but it's got this one program called the Jesus Christ Show. And I actually talked to the guy, and he said, you know, it's really difficult trying to play the role of Jesus Christ. I mean, you know, just when somebody gets mad at you, what do? Right. Who did I do an interview with, Cam? It was Tom Likas. Yeah, he's not there anymore. He was there a while ago. In fact, they got him off the air shortly after I was interviewed because he was just so incredibly rude. I mean, in fact, I was sitting down by the microphone. He was standing up yelling into his. He never sat down. And you know, some guy called in and said, you know, I'd like to hear how Dr. Ross came to faith in Christ. This guy wouldn't even let me get my testimony out. Man, I'm not exaggerating. I could not put a single sentence together. So, but he was angry. He was upset. He had another angry atheist on with him trying to yell me down. So, but yeah, Tom's no longer there. Yes. Wow. I didn't know that. That's great. Okay, let's spend some time in Job 38. And we got any time left over, I'll talk to you about a new discovery on the sun. But if not, we'll leave that for next week. Okay, one of the things we've been, by the way, we've spent quite a bit of time here in the class in Job 38. Because Job 38 is one of the three creation texts outside of Genesis that actually takes you through every one of the six creation days of Genesis 1. And so this is a great place to go to resolve difficulties or misunderstandings or misinterpretations of Genesis chapter 1, because it actually addresses in paragraph length every one of the six creation days. And so we spent some time doing that. And by the way, there are two other chapters of the Bible that do that, Psalm 104 and Proverbs chapter 8. But what we're doing now is going through Job 38, and this is where the Lord speaks to the five men for the first time. In fact, if you look at most Bibles, it will start off Job 38 with a little note saying, the Lord speaks. And really what the Lord is doing is asking a lot of questions. And this is like a big science test. So you can think of the Lord giving these five men an SAT science test. And you know, I kind of went through the chapter and counted how many questions the Lord poses to Job, Elihu, Zophar, Eliphaz, and Bildad. And I counted 59 questions, although depending how you read the text, you could come up with as many as 64 questions. 64 might be a good answer, I don't know, but 59 minimum science questions that he poses to Job, Elihu, Zophar, Eliphaz, and Bildad. Now these are men that lived 3,500 years ago, or possibly even earlier than 3,500 years ago. And one question we can ask is, okay, how well did these five men do answering God's creation science quiz? And the answer is they could not answer a single question. So they score 0 out of 59 in answering these questions. Okay, today we're at the height of the scientific revolution. In fact, I gave a talk when I was back in Tennessee how, you know, we're quite probably at the very apex of scientific advance. Because as we go into the future, there will be things that come into effect that's going to slow down our scientific advance. Not that it won't continue to advance, but we're probably living in that time in history when science is advancing at the most rapid rate. And, you know, we're living 3,500 years later. We've had the benefit of the Industrial Revolution, the scientific revolution. Knowledge is expanding at an incredible rate today. How well can we do on this science test that God poses to these five men in Job 38? Well, we do a little bit better. I count that there are 9 questions out of the 59 plus that we can answer. Now, not answer completely, but give somewhat decent answers to 9 of these 59 plus questions. So, but then a question I wanted to ask myself on this, of all the questions the Lord asks, how many should we be able to answer? You know, it's kind of something I've done as a physics professor. You know, you have your students there, and you set a quiz for them, and you have in the back of your mind, okay, now, if these students are really paying attention to what I'm teaching them and they're reading the textbook, how many questions on this test should they be able to answer? And you know, I try to design a test in such a way that a good student should be able to answer, say, 80 to 90% of the questions on the test. By the way, I've always made it a policy to make my test hard enough that even very good students are unlikely to get 100%. And the reason why I've always done that as a professor, I want to leave room for the really, really exceptional student. And if you make the test too easy, you're not going to have any way to measure someone who's truly exceptional taking the class. So I try to do that, and I say, well, you know, the Lord probably is operating from that same perspective. But if we had really been paying attention to what the Lord's been trying to teach us about science and creation, how many questions really should we be able to answer? And the whole point of all this is God gave a command in Genesis 1:28 to Adam and Eve. And, you know, to summarize that command, he said to Adam and Eve and their descendants, you are to manage the resources of the entire planet for the benefit not only of yourselves but of all life. Now, that requires a little bit of science knowledge to be able to do that. So, I mean, I look at that as a mandate, one of the mandates in Scripture for the human race to study science. Because, after all, how can we manage this planet if we don't know what the planet's all about, if we don't know the life forms that are there? But the truth is, we haven't done too well in trying to get the science knowledge we need to manage the planet for the benefit of all life. Why? Because we sin. And you know, sin makes us selfish and lazy and makes us ignore what God is trying to tell us, and therefore we wind up learning less. But the point I wanted to ask myself on this is, if we had not fallen into sin and rebellion against God in the Garden of Eden, about how many questions can we expect to be able to answer if we had really taken seriously God's command in Genesis 1:28? And I estimate that about 45 of these approximately 60 questions we should be able to answer. Now, we can answer 9, but in that sense, we're not really doing too well from God's perspective. His expectation would be that we should be able to answer 45. And so what about the other 15? Well, the other 15 questions are in the context of God explaining to these 5 men that he is unlimited, whereas we human beings are confined to the space-time manifold of the universe. And so there are limitations in what we can learn. And one of the points he's bringing out in Job 38 is the difference between his knowledge and the limits or the potential of human knowledge. And so 15 of the questions approximately expose that difference between God's ability to know and our ability to know. And, you know, back in 1930, the German mathematical physicist Kurt Gödel actually formalized this in a set of theorems called the incompleteness theorems, which, you know, it's a set of theorems, but it has that as its base, the fact that we human beings face fundamental limitations because of the physics of the universe and the space-time dimensions of the universe about what we can learn. There are certain things where our knowledge must be incomplete, no matter how much money and people and scientists we throw at the problem. And it's interesting that Job actually exposes that. So one of the things I made note of here in my Bible is that Job 38, the Lord here, the text here, is predicting Kurt Gödel's incompleteness theorems. They weren't invented till 1930, but Job 38 actually makes the statement to the effect that there are fundamental limitations based on physics and space and time that prevent us from getting the answers to certain questions. But those limitations don't apply to 45 of the questions. So, you know, we should have good answers to 45. We only have good answers to 9 of these questions. So in that sense, that's a really good indication of the degree to which sin has affected our capacity to advance the frontiers of scientific knowledge. Then I tried to do a little careful examination of the 9 questions we can answer. And I've shared this with you when I was here just before all my trips I took off on, is that each one of those 9 questions that we can answer serves a critical apologetic purpose. And so what I wanted to do today is try to get through these nine questions that we can answer and show you how each one of those nine questions we can answer serves a significant apologetic purpose. In other words, it provides us with a tool to help us reach non-Christians for faith in Christ. So I'm just going to start going through these, and if you can't follow or don't understand, please interrupt. For those of you that are new, this is a class that's highly interruptive, which is why it takes us so many years to get through things like the Book of Revelation. We got through it in 7 years. And then we got through the three creation accounts in Genesis. I think it took us 4 years to get through those. But that's because we encourage interruption. We encourage discussion, dialogue, debate, disputes. So I have at it as we go through this. But the first question I picked up in Job 38, and by the way, we're going to spend some time on the questions we can't answer. But I thought, let's do the easy stuff first. Let's look at the questions we can answer. And the first one I spotted here, and by the way, if you guys can spot others, feel free to add them to my list. I can only find nine that we could answer. But that's verse 8, first part of verse 8. Who can shut up the sea behind doors? And, this is something that we now have some understanding on scientifically, exactly how it was that God took this planet Earth, where there was an ocean that covered the whole surface of the Earth, and transformed it in a planet where we've got continents and we've got oceans. In fact, there is a book, I think, on our table there, not written by us, but written by an agnostic and an atheist scientist called Rare Earth. And probably a third of the content of the book Rare Earth is on this amazing miracle by which we wind up with a planet that has continents and oceans. And, here are two scientists, one an agnostic and one an astronomer, just saying this is so amazing that this must be the only planet in the universe that would have these conditions on it. But it talks about all the scientific discoveries that have been made, which established, number one, that the primordial Earth really did have a universal ocean. You'd have this planet that's turned into a molten state by these meteoritic and asteroid collision events. And when that finally cools, that kind of makes a billiard ball Earth. And so the water that forms above that will really cover the whole face of the Earth. But how the Earth was supernaturally endowed with huge quantities of uranium and thorium, which provides a driving engine for plate tectonics. And you'll see that in the Rare Earth book. It's also in our book, Origins of Life, the last chapter. I write a little thing that summarizes some of this evidence. I won't go into all of the details, but it is something whereby we now have fairly complete scientific understanding exactly how the continents formed. And by the way, the continents are still growing. God said in this process whereby initially the continents grew very slowly, and then they grew very rapidly, and now they're growing slowly. And it all depends on erosion makes the continents smaller. But plate tectonics, earthquakes and volcanoes make the continents larger. And so today we see that the continents are very slowly getting larger. Erosion's making them smaller. So for example, the states on the eastern seaboard, someone here is from an eastern seaboard state. Wasn't there someone from South Carolina? Your state's getting smaller and smaller as every year goes by as a result of erosion. You're moving inland. Okay, but we here in California, this is a state that's getting bigger and bigger as every year goes by, thanks to earthquake activity. And so, you might be thinking it's getting kind of crowded here in Southern California. The good news is if we wait a few million years, there will be more room in which we can live. I keep reminding my sons we're the owners of future mountaintop property. And then Hawaii is a state that's actually growing faster than any other state in the Union, thanks to the volcanic eruptions. Yes. Okay. Yeah, if you go back to creation day one, what you have is a planet where plate tectonics has not been operating long enough to produce much relief. So the fact that we have these deep ocean basins and high mountain ranges is thanks to plate tectonic activity. But it takes billions of years for that plate tectonic activity to produce deep ocean basins and high mountain ranges. So in the beginning, yeah, there would be enough water to cover the whole face of the earth because there wasn't much relief. But once the relief is established, then the water can't cover the face of the earth. In fact, I think we spent some time in the class going through five passages in the Bible that make it clear that the flood of Noah cannot possibly be global because of the fact, for example, Psalm 104 makes a statement that once God sets up the continents, the waters will never again cover the face of the earth. So that happened on the third creation day. So from creation day 3 forward, there can never be waters covering the whole face of the earth. So the water world scenario, I think there was a movie called Water World, that scenario existed in the early history of the earth. It cannot exist once the continents form. And that's because the continental growth has always been greater than the erosion rate wearing them down. But there was a period between about 2.5 billion years ago and 0.5 billion years ago when the continents grew very rapidly. Now they're into a slow phase. So it started off slow, became rapid, and now it's back in a slow phase. But the apologetic value of this is that this is an example where you can say the Bible was accurate in its statements about creation, and it was accurate in its predictions about creation. This is a key prediction made in Genesis chapter 1 that God has allowed us through our scientific discoveries to confirm. And incidentally, it's only been recently that we've been able to do that. I remember when I wrote my first booklet on Genesis 1 and made the statement that the text, in my opinion, indicated that water once covered the whole face of the earth. At that time, the geophysical research community was adamant that that was false. They said, oh no, the continents have always been here. But probably starting about 10 years ago, geophysicists revised what they thought about the early earth and said, oh no, what we're now talking about is water is actually covering the whole face of the earth. The discovery of what's called the late heavy bombardment is what finally solidified the scientific community's acceptance of the fact that what Genesis 1 says is right on the money. Because there was an event 3.85 billion years ago that liquefied the entire planet. So there were no rocks. The rocks were liquefied, and that would make for a nice smooth billiard ball. And when those rocks finally cooled, you would get water condensing on top of those rocks, and that would really cover the whole face of the earth. And it's also something we should have known even back 30 years ago. In fact, I made note of that in my first booklet of Genesis 1. If water didn't cover the whole face of the earth, how come the earliest fossils are all marine fossils? You know, just on that basis alone, you would expect that there would have to be water covering the whole face of the earth. But the whole point is God has allowed scientists to make this amazing discovery, and this amazing discovery gives us proof, gives us evidence that what Genesis 1 and Job 38 and Psalm 104 state about the primordial conditions of the earth, in fact, is accurate. And before I take the question, let me just make this one additional statement. You know, there are over 100 creation accounts in the different religions of the world. The Bible is the only creation account that says that the world starts off with a universal water. You know, waters covering the whole face of the earth that are later transformed where you get oceans and the continents. So the fact that it's unique to the Bible said it thousands of years ago, and only in the late 20th century has scientists discovered this to be correct. I would argue gives us a powerful apologetic argument for saying this indeed is the Word of God. How else can you explain such an amazing statement being in Scripture? Yes. Right. Okay, well, I think I mentioned this in the class, and maybe I didn't. You're new here. But I think about 5-6 weeks ago, I made note of a discovery whereby asteroids were striking the Earth, and geophysicists for the first time been able to measure the damage caused by this asteroidal collision event. And they did it actually by looking at the moon. When we observed the moon, we noticed that there's a whole bunch of craters there. And for decades, astronomers said those craters are there because of impact events. A new discovery is that the basins on the moon, the lunar basins, what they call the seas, are also the result of collision events. Collision events that were so enormous, it liquefied that part of the lunar surface and turned it into what we now see as a sea. While that being the case, you recognize that Earth has 30 times the gravitational signature of the moon. So we would take 30 times the damage from some blast of the inner solar system of these comets and asteroids. And by that means, they calculated that at a minimum, the top 200 kilometers of the Earth were turned into a molten, or 4,700 degrees Fahrenheit. It's really warm. Warm enough that obviously we're talking the whole top of the planet being turned into a molten state. And therefore, when it does finally cool down, once the bombardment is over and it cools down, you're going to get this really smooth billiard ball shape to the Earth's interior. And then as it becomes cool enough, water will condense on top of it and form this ocean that covers the whole top of that. Yeah, the water is turned into steam.
You could almost calculate with your gravity how much water that really is, and that kind of limits the amount of water.
Right, right.
Wouldn't have some of that maybe not based on
that? Well, the water content of the planet has remained relatively constant for about 4.25 billion years.
So even when it vaporized, it would not have stayed.
Some leaves. In fact, some water today is leaving the planet. But the water that leaves, we only lose a tiny amount. Fortunately, we live on a planet with a strong enough gravitational signature that water that makes it up into the upper atmosphere typically remains. But there is a very tiny escape, gravitational escape of water from the planet. But that very tiny gravitational escape is balanced by the comets that are infalling on Earth. Comets are about 80% water. And so every day we receive a fresh supply of water from outer space, not much, but it's enough to balance the water that leaves. And this has been going on for over 4 billion years. So the water content of the planet has been relatively constant over that whole period of time. Now sometimes, like with the late heavy bombardment, it was turned to steam, but it didn't leave. And then when the planet cooled, that steam condensed and made liquid water and formed this ocean that covered the whole surface of the planet.
So if the Earth had twice the amount of water, would it have a, let's say, fire? Would that have left and not turned?
Well, this is a question that's raised in the book Rare Earth, because the astronomer there is one of the co-authors, says, what if Earth had twice the water content? He says, if it had twice the water content, there'd be no advanced life on our planet. We'd have a water world scenario, and that would be okay for the bacteria, but it'd be a huge problem for advanced life. And so one of the questions is raised in the book Rare Earth is how come Earth has so little water? From an astronomer's perspective, our planet should have a whole lot of water. I mean, if you look at Europa, for example, and Ganymede, they got way more water than the Earth has. And so the big question has always been, how come Earth has so little water? Because its gravity is such that it doesn't lose much water out of space. It's easy to explain Mars. Mars just doesn't have a big gravity signature. Likewise, Mercury doesn't have a big gravity signature, so it's going to lose water out of space. The answer to the question, how come we got so little water, is because there is an event whereby a Mars-sized planet collided with the Earth, and that collision event got rid of 99% of all the volatiles on planet Earth. So we had this very heavy atmosphere, loads of water, loads of carbon dioxide, and thanks to that collision event that led to the formation of the moon, we got rid of all those nasty volatiles and wound up with very little carbon dioxide, only a tiny amount of water, and this is what you need for advanced life. And you know, that's one of the more amazing design arguments for our planet, is the fact that the planet's big enough not to lose water and yet received a collision whereby its early volatiles would have escaped to outer space. And so you can run through a probability. What's the probability of that happening by chance? That's something you see in our books. Question over here.
Yeah,
That's a very good point. This is a great way to reach out to our young earth creationist brethren. Say, you know, you're right about the global flood. There was a flood that covered the whole face of the earth. It was early in earth's history, long before God created Adam and Eve, that this had happened. And we've got five places in the Bible, Psalm 33, Job 38, Psalm 104, Proverbs 8, and 2 Peter 3, which all state that once you got the continents, the water can never again cover the whole face of the earth. And therefore, at that point, you can take your young earth creationist friend back into Genesis and say, does the text teach a global flood, or is it merely teaching a universal flood? And, you know, you can take him through, particularly chapter 8 of Genesis makes it clear we're talking a universal flood, not a global flood. The distinction being, a universal flood would be big enough to wipe out all of humanity, but not big enough to wipe out the emperor penguins in Antarctica. Yes. There's lots of granite in the crusts, and the granite that's in the crusts can be attributed to the way the Earth formed. Earth is loaded with a lot of igneous rocks, but it has to do with the collision event would have given us an extra amount of those igneous rocks. And yes, I think what you are getting at is that there are events in Earth's history which bring up that igneous material from the mantle to the surface. In fact, Hawaii is a place where we can document that material even from the core is being brought to the surface. One of the reasons why Hawaii has such rich agricultural lands is that its lava is very different than the lava you have, say, in places in California. I mean, look at the lava flows in northeastern California. They're not very conducive to agriculture, but the lava flows in Hawaii are. And there's a difference because the lava comes from a different location inside the earth. Yes? Okay, in terms of life period, probably 0.4%. If you were to move the earth 0.4% farther away or closer to the sun, you would get either a runaway freeze-up or you would get a runaway boiling off of the water. And that would be deadly, not just for advanced life, but for all life. I mean, if you turn the entire planet into something like Antarctica, that's going to be tough for life. And if all the water escapes to outer space, that's going to be tough for life, too. So, and that only takes 0.4%. I don't know if anyone has calculated the fine-tuning that would be necessary for advanced life. And, you know, part of that depends on, okay, are we talking advanced life with a high population and high technology, or are we talking advanced life with a low population and relatively little technology? You'll get two different answers on that fine-tuning. And something we see here in Job 38, that God has blessed our planet such that we have five different kinds of rainfall. We have fog, we have mist, we have rain, we have snow, we have hail. And you can see these are all mentioned here in the text. And the whole point is these are in balance in order to make sure that we have a planet with an enormous biomass and biodiversity. And that's what's really necessary to support a high human population with a high level of technology. But if you're willing to have just a million of us at a Stone Age culture level, then we don't have to fine-tune this water cycle to quite that degree, in which case you might be able to tolerate something like a 0.2% difference rather than something that would be much smaller than that. But certainly the fine-tuning is smaller for human beings than it would be for, say, bacteria. Yes? Yes. Okay, I'm trying to remember the figure for water as a percentage of the entire planet. I think it's in the neighborhood of 0.01%. Okay, Europa is 15% water, so it's like 1,500 times the water content per unit volume that the Earth has, and the Ganymede comes in at about 65% water. So yeah, in that context, Earth is water poor. So yeah, a rocky planet that's not too hot should have lots and lots of water. And we have just a tiny amount of water. And that is a point brought up in the book Rare Earth. The miracle of the fact that Earth has got so little water. And 0.01%. I think it's 0.02% we have. If you go to the book Origins of Life, I give you the figure and a reference. But I believe it's 0.02%. Yes. Yeah, I listed 4A, 4B, 5A, 5B, 6A, 6B, 7A, and 7B as questions we can't give complete answers to. We got some idea. When it says, you know, where were you when I laid the Earth's foundations? Who marked off its dimensions? Who stretched the measuring line across it? On what were its footings set? We've got some idea of exactly how the Earth got the size it got, how it got the composition it got, but we do not have complete understanding. We got relatively complete understanding of how the continents formed, but we really lack the understanding. How is it the Earth got the composition that it has? We're getting close. I mean, we're getting some idea. In fact, I'm kind of collecting material on this, and it's like you need three different kinds of supernova, and you need two different kinds of white dwarfs in order to explain the mix of elements that we have. And we're just talking the elements you need for life. And one of the amazing things about advanced life is you need lots of rare earth elements to make advanced life work. And this is one of the amazing things about our planet, is it's got significant quantities of virtually every element in the atomic chart. However, those elements are made by specialist stars. And, you know, most planetary systems will have the good fortune of being blessed by one set of elements, but they'll miss all the rest. And we have to be living on a planet where we got everything, which means you have to have a formation history which allows you to be exposed to all these events, but not overexposed. And so astronomers are still trying to figure out exactly how it is that the primordial solar system happened to have just the right exposure. There's a lot of things that are still missing in that understanding. Yes. Well, we can now see about 120 planets outside of our solar system. But all 120 have what's called a gas condensation formation history, which means they form from clouds of gas collapsing. And that's how the star formed, that's how the planets formed around the star. What we realize about our solar system is it formed not through gas condensation, but through pebbles sticking together thanks to the glue of polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons. That may seem like a 50-cent term. I'll give you an easy term, barbecue tar. Okay, you look on your barbecue and there's all... And you notice how sticky that stuff is? I mean, it's really sticky. Anybody who's tried to scrape that stuff off their grill knows how sticky that stuff is. Well, our solar system was blessed with a whole lot of that stuff. And rather than gas forming, we had a bunch of little pebbles. And the pebbles were stuck together thanks to these barbecue tars, and then that formed bigger rocks, which then stuck together to bigger rocks. And this allowed a planetary system to form where you would get small rocky planets. And so there's a growing recognition amongst astronomers that this assumption that if you've got planets like Jupiter, you're going to have rocky planets accompanying them may not be correct. It could be very rare indeed to find a planetary system that has a formation pathway that ours did. And so far, we've yet to detect a planetary system that has a formation history that's like our own. So there may be lots of planetary systems, but this still may be the one, maybe the only, that has the kinds of planets you would need to make life possible. It's not discussed in any of our books because this thing I'm talking to Ross about is a discovery that was made, I think, about 7 weeks ago. So,
don't have a book out
on it yet, no. However, if you go to our website, look up today's new reason to believe, you'll see a discussion. And we also discussed it, there's an article there you can read, and was also discussed on our Creation Update webcast. So you can listen to about a 15-minute discussion of this discovery. But it'll be a while before it shows up in one of our books. So, time's... All right, I was planning to get through all nine of these. So, yeah, we'll do that when I come back here. But, you know, what's interesting is these nine discoveries, each one gives us a powerful tool for showing that the Bible indeed accurately predicts future scientific discoveries, and is the only book that does that. But it also allows us, I mean, some of these verses that we're talking about where we have answers also help resolve major interpretation crises that we see in the creation accounts of the Bible. And what I mean by an interpretation crisis is where the church is divided over how to interpret the text. And so some of the things in Job allow us to deal with that. And the thing that I find incredible, some of them actually cut both ways. It gives you a proof that the Bible is accurately predicting future scientific discoveries. At the same time, it resolves an interpretive crisis. And so I like the fact that God writes his Bible in such a way that it serves multiple purposes at the same time. Yes? You want the nine verses? Okay. First part of 8, which is what we covered today. Second part of verse 9, where it talks about God wrapping the oceans in thick darkness with his clouds. Verse 16a, have you journeyed to the springs of the deep, which I believe refers to deep sea vents. Verse 19b, where does darkness reside? Which I believe refers to all these neat discoveries about where dark matter exists, different kinds of dark energy, etc. Verse 22a, have you entered the storehouses of the snow? And verse 22b, have you seen the storehouses of the hail? Which kind of gets into the point I'm making about how we live on a planet where we got fog, we got mist, we got hail, we got snow, we got rain. You need all five for advanced life. And then 24a, what is the way to the place where the lightning is dispersed? And I think we spent an entire class talking about the design of lightning that's here in the text and how that gives us new evidence. And then last of all, verse 31, can you bind the beautiful Pleiades? Can you loose the cords of Orion? Two star clusters that we see. One is gravitationally bound. The other one is falling apart. The Bible said it 3,500 years ago. We just discovered it a few decades ago. So that's a quick summary. And by the way, we tape, I think, every class we do here. So if you want to get the tape of the next one, we can make that happen for you. I'm 4 minutes over time. We're going to pray, and then we'll close. Father in heaven, we thank you for blessing us with this amazing book, the Bible. And, you know, in spite of all the incredible discoveries that scientists have made, this book is far more advanced in its science than we are. Lord, that may that bring some measure of humility into our lives, and may we be gifted by you to communicate that humility as we witness to our non-Christian friends and associates. Lord, help us to stimulate our friends and associates with some enthusiasm and anticipation of what the Bible can reveal for them. Help us to make them spiritually thirsty. And Father, we thank you that we live in a day and an age when people are thirsty. Bring us into contact with those people. I pray, Father, every member of this class would see fruit, see people coming to faith in Christ through new reasons to believe. In Jesus' name, amen.